from the National Salt Health Laboratory, or you have a new name now, I believe. Thank you, Sally.
As Tim mentioned, we have a new name for our lab. We're now the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment. Kind of what I want to discuss in this talk, I want to mention briefly how many decades ago we didn't have the good tools to look at soil water changes over time, and now we do. Time domain reflectometry was introduced, oh, almost 30 years ago. But early on, there were some problems that had developed, and some of them have already been mentioned in previous talks, but we can get good data with TDR. We have other kinds of soil water probes that don't have some of the difficulties that TDR had, but they have their own difficulties. But with some of these probes, at least, we can get some good data if we were using certain careful procedures. Now let's get back to where we were 30 years ago when we didn't have the tools, and now we do. And let's keep on imagining what we can learn with these procedures. And this is just mentioning what I had said. Taylor and Klepper had said, we need data on hourly. They were thinking even hourly rather than daily basis. Back then, we didn't have the tools. And if you haven't read it, you should really look up this little summary by Clark Toppin, how when he first was working with TDR and how he was trying to get it into the mainstream. He was really not the first person to use dielectric to look at water content, but he was the first one to popularize it. However, early on, I think you've seen this in some of the other talks, there were some difficulties with TDR. We noticed down here with the high temperature and some of these soils that have high charge, we don't get that rebound in the waveform. Now, there are a lot of software you can buy that'll handle this with no problem. However, early on, we didn't have enough memory to save these waveforms, and we just let the whatever instrument we were using do the internal calculation, and those internal calculations really did not do a good job on that kind of waveform. This is just an example of a partial setup I had actually tried, besides being quite expensive. We have the cable tester, sorry, my arrow up here, transient suppressor, which we know now we should never have used, multiplexers, coaxial cables, even though they're low loss, they're really, really long. There's a lot of stuff in here that interfered with our measurements, say the least. This is an example of some of the data I got from that setup. A lot of noise. I think maybe we got, it's comparing it with neutron probe. We got maybe this dry period there, but it totally missed that one and missed the one up there, and really was not very useful for looking at water content. Well, so what would you want to do if you're using TDR? Well, first of all, you want to get rid of those extension cables. Obviously, get rid of the transient suppressor. Here we're showing we got the cable tester at each spot with only short extension coaxial cables. Save all the waveforms, always. You want to go back and look at them. And if there's anything weird, there's software that can handle those weird waveforms. You can process them, you know, as you get them, but make sure you save them in case there's something you have to look at again. I know some of you work in research sites where you've got electricity and all. I've not usually had that luxury. I may be out in the farmer's field. I don't have a source of electricity. Luckily, the data loggers today have a lot more memory than the data loggers did, you know, 20, 25 years ago or whatever. You may still need, as you've heard in some of the talks, some site-specific calibrations. So then there's other probes. This is an example of, in this case, a Campbell Scientific 616 probe. I can't say these are the right water contents, but at least it seems to be following some kind of pattern. And with the neutron probe, it's kind of following the pattern, all except for the first point. The first week or so before rain, I get the impression there was some poor contact and the rain kind of washed the soil down around the probe. Oh, and because you don't have any waveform or coaxial cables. Of course, there are some problems. Now, I want to mention that this particular calibration that I'm showing here, I'm showing water content on the y-axis and like the square root of the permittivity on the x-axis. This is kind of backwards from what was just shown in the last talk, just in case you're wondering. The laboratory calibration was a nice linear function, not so for the field. So what's going on in the field that it doesn't really match the lab? The lab, of course, we can get nice uniform, homogeneous water content. The field, it seems, especially when you get to the subsoil, you get more uneven wetting. We see that these intermediate water contents, that the dielectric is much higher than you would expect from the laboratory measurements, but then towards the wet and dry end, they kind of tend to match better. It seems that perhaps some of these other kind of probes don't average as well along the probe as the TDR did, that they may be the electromagnetic field is kind of honing in on the wet soil, especially if there's a mixture of wet and dry soil, possibly. I want to mention this briefly, at least to kind of mention when I'm talking about problem soil what I mean. This is actually a map for ground penetrating radar, which is another type of dielectric instrument. This is from the NRCS soils website. The green colors indicate soils that are very useful for this procedure and for TDR. You may even get by with the factory calibration, maybe, on those soils. You get to the pink soils, they have high salt, and we've already heard a lot about how salt can cause problems. You get to these, you know, these browns and oranges, like the vertisols in Texas and some places in the Midwest and Great Lakes areas. And those soils are kind of iffy because of the high charge clays, which almost have the same effect as salt. If you look at the frequency dependence of the real and imaginary parts of permittivity, this is the real part at three water contents. This is the imaginary component at three water contents. We can see that the real part, there's a slight increase. This is for a soil. Now, for a clay, it would be a lot more. For a soil, there's a slight increase at the lower frequencies. However, for the imaginary component, there's a large increase at lower frequencies. When you determine the apparent permittivity, which many of the probes, including TDR, actually calculate, you get a pretty large increase in permittivity at the lower frequencies that's unrelated to water content. And of course, probes come out all the time, so I probably don't have all the latest, but this is just sort of a sampling of approximate frequency zone, and we're down around 50 to 200 megahertz, which is kind of in this region where you're starting to get some effect of this frequency dependence. And I wanted to get back a little bit to that uneven wetting idea. We had packed a column with dry and wet alternating, see dry, dry, you know, of water, and then another column which was more homogeneous. And then we used the Campbell Scientific 616 water content reflectometer in each column. And then we looked at the response with the square root of the apparent permittivity. The columns were sealed, so they weren't really drying very much during the study. But the column that had wet and dry parts had a larger permittivity than the homogeneous column. But, you know, many of these probes, you can still get some good data. Of course, you're going to need site-specific calibration. You may need some temperature corrections. You may need to separate out wet and dry sections of your calibration curve. You might consider that, why is that wrinkled? Oh well. Some of the probes will separate out the real and imaginary part. I know the Hydra probe and some of the newer echo probes will separate that out. And that's even to your advantage because the real component seems a little bit less sensitive to the temperature and salts and clays than the imaginary or the apparent component. And just another thought I had, I know that they had done this study where they had looked at thin layers of materials and it's a function, and the permittivity is a function of frequency and some mixing models. And we like, you know, in the TDR, when you get to the higher frequencies, you can use the square root of the permittivity and relate it to linearly to water content. But they were showing as you go to lower frequencies that exponent, rather than being square root, gets closer to 1. That doesn't completely linearize it, but it's just an effect that maybe some of this nonlinearity is because we're at lower frequencies. Okay, now let's get back to why we got these probes in the first place. And the laboratory studies are good, they're important, but really what do we want to look? We want to look at plant water use, freeze-thaw, I think that was mentioned in one of the studies, wetting fronts, drying fronts, preferential flow, wetting zones in water-repellent soils, row and inner row, landscape differences. I'm going to mention just a little bit of data from a study. Here's our plant. Use your imagination. Okay, this is just diagrammatically, this is in two dimensions, where it's looking like there's a bunch of probes right underneath the other, but in three dimensions, they're really spread out, so they're really not right underneath each other. But at 5 and 15 centimeters, we had row and inner row probes in horizontally. Now, we had to put these in after planting in a farmer's field without causing a lot of disturbance. So these other probes were put in at an angle where you could dig a small hole and stick your arm in and put the probe in at an angle. We got down at 0.3, 0.5, 0.7, 0.9, and 1.1 meter depth. And then we also had available to us some evaporation data, ET data, and we looked at the evaporation data compared to the soil water loss. The soil water loss, right after a rain, of course, there might be some variations, but if you went a few days after a rain, the soil water loss was less than the evaporation loss. And there's some reasons that that occurs. And I was saying that we have a situation where the water table is within this range. And so when I looked at soil water, I just looked at the probes above the water table. That we're actually getting the water table being so close that as the soil is drying, there's a gradient upward from the water table. And this is what I mean. It had rained on day 173. Initially, this net flux is negative, meaning there's greater soil water loss than evaporation. This is drainage. I'm not quite sure why we get the little positive flux and then another negative flux. I'm not quite sure, but it's following the same trend. This is the evaporation trend. This is the soil water flux trend, water flux up into or out of the zone of measurement of the soil of the unsaturated zone. During this time, the water table ranged from about 80 centimeters to 120 centimeters. Starting at about day 181 until it rained again on day 190, there was a net positive flux because it had not rained for 2 weeks or for 16 days. And I'm saying that this flux was the flux up from the water table. And it was up to as much as 2 or 3 millimeters a day, pretty big component. So that's just one thing we did with these kind of probes. Another thing I looked at, and other people have done this, you know, where even to 50 centimeters, some have shown with a corn plant that funnels the water, you get the stem flow, and you also get that water increase following the stem right down into the soil. So looking at the 5 and 15 centimeter depth probes at row versus inner row, there was, on every major rain event, there was more water increase in the row than the inner row, which is what we expect. And we see that. And then I looked at the times between rains, except anything that was more than a day or two, and there was more soil or loss of water in the row than the inner row. And there was like maybe a millimeter of lateral movement from the row to the inner row, but a lot of this is just actual greater loss. There's more water there to start with, there's more roots there in the row, there was more evaporation. I looked at soybean. In the following year, there wasn't any real consistent trend. Soybean doesn't funnel the water the same way that corn does. And then for the drying, no really major effect there, the soybean. For that data I had shown before, for that 16 days without rain, if I took this, that last week, day 181 to 189, this is a little more than a week, and then I averaged the hourly change in soil water and the hourly change in evaporation, in the water table depth, I converted the water table depth to actual depth of water lost from the water table. Okay? So, obviously, your evaporation curve, you start getting some evaporation 5 or 6 a.m., peaks about hour 13, continues on to about hour 19. Soil water, there's actually some increase in soil water in places, and then it doesn't really start drying the soil till about hour 8, or about 3 hours later. Now, some of that could be dew. We'd get a lot of dew condensation. And the peak is less, as we showed before. There's less water loss than evaporation. There's water loss from the water table that continues for probably 5 hours after the evaporation has started to decrease. And I'm saying that this is because the water's moving up to replace that, which was lost in the soil from evaporation. And that's why we can never totally measure evaporation with the soil water loss, because the water table is so shallow. It's moving up and replacing it. So the net conclusion I have from this is we need to get more of these instruments out in the field looking at fluxes. I just did a quick scan of the last 5 years, you know, some searches of how these papers we've had in our journals, our society journals, and with these different, with TDR or some of these other soil water sensors. And 3/4 of the paper were lab studies, calibration studies, or theoretical studies. We need that. But only 1/4 was actually using the equipment in the field to look at, you know, flux, freeze, thaw. Let's kind of reverse that. Let's do 3/4 of our study actually using the equipment that we didn't have available 30, 40 years ago, but now we do. And let's start looking at what's going on out there. And this is just an example of that at the end of that time on day 190 when it rained, this was the 1 hour before the rain. That was 3 hours after the profile change. Thank you. And I'll take answer to questions.
Yes, we have time for questions.
Yeah.
Just taking on your last point about the use of TDR and how frequently it's used. One of the things that I've found is difficult with TDR is it's become so commonplace that it doesn't show up in keywords or titles or anything else anymore. I think the use may be broader.
Yeah, that could very well be true. I tried to look in topics that might be related, even though, you know, I looked on abstracts and, you know, right, but I probably missed a few. Oh, I've explained it all. You'll understand it perfectly. Great.
Could you explain a little more about the use of piezometers in your study? Or are you looking at groundwater flux from piezometer data?
No, our groundwater flux was all from a water balance. We had the eddy correlation evaporation data. We had the change in soil water in the unsaturated zone. And we were, because the change in soil water in the unsaturated zone, and I was looking at specifically at times when the water table was right within that measurement or just below that measurement zone, that the soil water change is always less than the evaporation. Of course, right after a rain, you get some canopy interception. But when you're a week or two after a rain, that's not canopy interception. I'm saying that that's because we're getting this gradient as the soil dries out. I mean, even in this profile, you know, after 2 weeks without rain, the soil is dried out down to, sorry, I'm getting this thing not going the right direction. It's dried out to, you know, 70 centimeters. And the water table, by that time, I think the water table was down to about 1.2 meters, but it's actually moving up according to the gradient that's created by that water drying, so that the water loss is not just the soil water loss that we can measure, but it's that extra stuff coming from the water table that we can't really measure indirectly. Yeah, that hydraulic lift is very important in some, especially in trees and some dicot plants. But the vascular tissue of corn, it doesn't have that secondary thickening. It doesn't have the same vascular structure as the dicot plants that were that have shown the hydraulic lift. I think that it might be difficult to get this hydraulic lift in corn because of that, unless there was some other mechanism. It doesn't have the same tissue arrangement.
Can I go forward, Steve? Oh, okay.